All right, we are this morning in Lesson 37 in our book, The History and Geography of the Bible Story. And we're now, for a little while, essentially, leaving the biblical trail and going to extra-biblical things. In other words, we're talking in here in Lesson 37 about world affairs during the years of biblical silence. So we're not going to find a whole lot of scriptures used here, but we are going to go through the things that, that affected the people in Israel and in other places in the number of years that we had between the Old Testament and the New Testament. All right, so I have a number of things that I wanted us to discuss about these years of biblical silence and some things that have to do with contemporary portrayals of this in the last number of years and such like as that. So, but what I want to do is sort of go through the PowerPoint presentation that we have here up until a certain point, and then we'll kind of, I think, diverge from that and look at some other stuff. All right, so as we look at the affairs of the world in the years of biblical silence, we want to remember that God became silent in this time after the return of the Jews to Jerusalem. And so that happened according to a prophecy. Interestingly enough, in the original slides on here, this said Amos predicted. Well, Amos was a prophet, so Amos prophesied. So if you look in chapter 8 and verse 11 of Amos, American Standard Version, it says, "Behold, the days come, saith the Lord, Jehovah, that I will send a famine in the land, not a famine of bread, nor a thirst for water, but of hearing the words of Jehovah." And near as I can tell, that's about the only place where it says something like that, but it seems to be pretty direct. In other words, Amos has told us here that there will be a famine of hearing the words of God. And so we see that indeed that did happen to be the case. As we look at the books of the Bible, we realize that they essentially end with Ezra, Nehemiah, Malachi, those prophets there. And we realize that nothing begins again until we see the story of Jesus start in the books of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. So indeed there was a silent period there, and we need to remember that. How many years was this silent period, approximately?
400 years.
About 400 years. That's quite a space of time. Once again, I'll liken that to the extent of the Kingdom of America. I mean, it's only been around since 1776, right? So that's only 239 years, right? Something like that. They didn't have the Word of God for 400 years. Once again, I'd like to emphasize the span of time that we have here in biblical history as compared to the span of time that we know anything about when we think about American history. So if we think of our nation being, 239 or whatever years old, and we look at these and feel that and see that God did not say anything to these people for 400 years, that's a long time. But then also when we look back at the history that we've been tracing, we have hundreds and hundreds of years. In some instances, we have a millennia of history that we can look at, which just dwarfs the history that we look at today. I remember when, a number of years ago, Linda and I went to Boston on a company trip. So that was nice. The company was able to pay for her to go. But anyway, we went to Boston, and we started walking around there, and we looked at that famous cemetery that's in downtown Boston where all the people are buried, and you go down there and you look at those tombstones, and those tombstones have dates on them from the 1500s and 1600s, and you go, wow, is that a long time ago? And you start walking around and realize that the history was way back when. But the thing is that we said that to ourselves, even though we lived in Egypt for 2 years and walked around on stones that were from 2000 B.C. And, of course, they didn't have dates printed on them. It said 2000 B.C. So, but I remember Susan, our oldest daughter, when we took a trip to Athens. We were up on the Acropolis, and she met another little girl on the bus, the tour bus that we had gotten for the local for the day. And so we were up on the Acropolis where the Parthenon is and all that sort of stuff. And you know, all of us adults are oohing and aahing at the structure and everything. And these two little girls are over here jumping on stones that have been tumbled down and sitting there since 2000 B.C. You know, wow, they knew the history that they were climbing on. So anyway, so really when we look at our comparison ruler that we have here as far as America goes, we're pretty young. Though when we do look at it, the type of government, the government that the United States has is the oldest continuous form of government in the world that has ever been. You say, well, the British Empire has been around longer, but they had a different form of government in the past. So the American government is the longest form of government, and it's only been around, like I say, for 239 years, if I added those numbers up right. And we're talking here about 400 years between the Testaments. So it's a lot of time to think about. And there's a point that will be made here that really you can see how the span of time comes into bearing on that. As we continue on that, we realize, though, that even though we've got a 400-year span of time here that God hasn't blessed the people with his word or prophets or anything like that, we realize, though, that God's plan is still on schedule, the way that he has scheduled it. What is it? All things come to him in his time or something like that. I don't know whether that's a really loose paraphrase or what, but he made all the prophecies that he needed to make regarding his son that was to come had been made. Everything was there. We see all sorts of messianic prophecies in Isaiah and Ezekiel. All sorts of things have been put into place by God, and that thing is still on schedule, even though we have a gap here of 400 years between the Old Testament and the New. So now it was time to wait for the fullness of time. And I always find that an interesting phrase because, you know, it talks about the fullness of the Gentiles, it talks about the fullness of this, the fullness of that, and the fullness of time. You think, you know that? That's for God to know. That's what God does. What is that, the scripture about the secret things of God? Is it was it Ezekiel? I knew that. Deuteronomy 29:29, as opposed to Ezekiel. Yes. Deuteronomy 29:29. If you get that, Chris, would you read that for us?
The secret things belong to the Lord our God, and the things revealed belong to us and to our sons forever, that we may observe all the words of this law.
Okay. So the secret things belong to God. The other things that he wants us to know about, he'll tell us about. It's interesting to note that as we look into not only biblical history but Old Testament history, but as we look in the New Testament and we look at people who want to rant and rave about the book of Revelation, they want to take a lot of the things that are the secret things of God and say that, oh, no, I've made this public. You know, God revealed this to me. No, God said the secret things belong to God. And so whatever the fullness of time was going to be, God knew what it was. And so his plan was still on schedule. Now, it's been a long time that his people have been his people, you might say. And this actual 400 years is really a brief span of time in the plan of God. And what does the New Testament say about God's timeline? One day is as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is as one day. God doesn't play with time. Or use time, or however you want to call it. All time is the same to God. So, though his plan is still on schedule, you know, many changes still take place between Malachi and Matthew. Remember that as we look at the close of the Old Testament, what kind, obviously this points it out, but what situation is Jerusalem in? I mean, to a large extent, these people were lazy and not dedicated to God. You almost had to hit them with a cattle prod to get them to do anything. So, who came down? Who came down with them in the first return? Who was the main leader there of the 50,000? Zerubbabel. And what did Zerubbabel try to get them to do? Build the temple, right? And what'd they do? They laid the foundation, and then what'd they do? Built their own houses. So we got a nice foundation laid over here, but they decided that, well, you know, there's a little bit of pressure here, and you know, the people of the land hate us and all that sort of stuff, and so rather than do something that they thought was going to cause them trouble with the people of the land, they decided, well, we'll just build our own houses. You know, we've got the foundation laid. And how long did it sit there gathering dust? 16 years. And then who came along? Ezra. How many and what folks did he bring along? He brought about 2,000-3,000 people. 1,776 men. It's interesting to note in the lesson book that you've got there, their comment is he brought along Levites who were reluctant to go. And that's true, because he called everybody together at this river where they were going to meet to go down. And he started counting people. He said, there aren't many Levites here. And he went out and specifically called the Levites and the singers, was it, Bruce? Priests and Levites, and also some singers, I think, the Nethinim, I think, is that who they were? Anyway, they didn't just show up by themselves. They had to be persuaded to come down there. And so when they left then, we have a listing of, according to my count, 1,776 men, and then it talks about the little ones also. Do you have your hand halfway up?
I mean, you're talking about what was the condition of Israel and Judah in the land. You talked in chapter 1, verse 6 about the fact that they were sowing much. I mean, they were working hard.
Haggai 1 and 6, right? They were working hard.
But there's not enough to be satisfied. You drink, there's not enough to come and drunk. You put on clothing that no one is warm enough. And he who earns wages to put into a person's holes. I mean, they were working, but they weren't being blessed. They weren't making any progress. And it's because they weren't putting God first.
Right. Right, because, as Haggai says in chapter 1, they were putting themselves first. Yeah, they were putting their wages into a bag with holes, and they weren't getting what they thought they ought to get because they weren't completing the mission for which God had sent them, which was to rebuild the temple. Bruce?
You know, Malachi, third chapter,
yeah.
Verse 13, he calls them, he says that they were ignorant.
Ignorant?
And they were against them. Not only that, but further down it says, you even test me with your wickedness.
Okay.
And try to escape, you know, through their lives.
Right.
So they were totally.
Yeah, Malachi had a lot to say about them and their complaints about why they weren't blessed, why Malachi was saying bad things about him when he said, we haven't done anything bad. You go, really? So. He spent a lot of time pointing that out to them. All right, so technically, if we look at it, the people that had come back from Babylonian captivity and perhaps some of the people that came from Assyrian captivity also with them, they came back. They finally, when Nehemiah came down, they got, not only did Ezra provoke them to finish the temple, and they finished it, and finally, in how many years? Four years, then Nehemiah came down, essentially by himself, and provoked them to do what? Build the wall. Okay, how long did it take them to build a wall? Why just 52 days? Because they had a mind to work. Yeah. And so they got it done. But still, you know, that didn't finish off the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. There were still lots of things that they were doing that they shouldn't have been doing. What particular things did he admonish them about?
Marrying other wives.
Okay, marrying foreign women. And what else? Another particularly egregious thing.
They were charging interest to each other.
They were doing that. That's right. What do we call it? Usury. And then one more thing. The Sabbath. They were profaning the Sabbath. So not only were they allowing the people of the lands to come into the gates of through the gates of Jerusalem on the Sabbath day to sell, they themselves apparently were doing that. So just because they got the temple built and the wall finished doesn't mean they were pure and white as snow. They were doing all sorts of other things that had to be fixed. So when we look at it, we realize that I think it's probably safe to say, as the authors here say, that the Old Testament closes with Judah as a poverty-stricken dependency under the control of Persia. And it's true. They were not particularly good followers of God. But when we go into the New Testament times, we see that a change has taken place. The New Testament opens and shows that Jerusalem is a prosperous place. It's in the middle of a prosperous region, and it's ruled by the Roman Emperor. So all of a sudden now Persia's gone, and 400 years of history have taken place in the interim, and now we have Rome. But in the biblical story, we haven't seen anybody mention anything even close to Rome, have we? I think the closest we've got is over in western Turkey. That's about it. They say here, we need to touch on the 400 years of secular history to bring us up to the beginning of the New Testament. There's certainly a lot that went on. We see, of course, that conditions changed over the years. Excuse me. In Nehemiah's days, of course, as we've already mentioned, they were negligent in observing the laws, the Sabbath, the marriage laws, the other one, usury. But when we look 450 years later, we see that Jesus found sects of Judaism that were very, very careful to observe the things according to the law as they saw it in every detail. We look at Matthew 23:23. That's an interesting one that actually I like to use quite a bit, because Matthew 23:23 is, it's in the midst of the woes, but that's the one that says, "Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for ye tithe mint and anise and cumin, and have left undone the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faith, but these ye ought to have done, and not to have left the others undone." So, by the time we come to the beginning of the New Testament, we see that now not only are they observant Jews, but they're so observant that they count the leaves on their mint bushes to make sure that when they tithe, they're tithing the right amount. But they're doing that rather than justice, mercy, and was it peace? Faith. Justice, mercy, and faith. So it's kind of like they've gone to the opposite extreme to a certain extent. Now we have what two major sects of Judaism do we have? Pharisees and the Sadducees. Okay, what is it about the Sadducees that we find strange, amongst other things? Right, they don't believe in the resurrection, angels, spirits, anything like that. The Pharisees, of course, believe both. Who used this difference between the Pharisees and the Sadducees against them in court? Not Jesus, Paul. He started talking and got them in an argument, and they had to drag him out of there because they thought they'd tear him to pieces because they were fighting amongst each other because the Pharisees said one thing and the Sadducees said another, and it was a very interesting thing. So Paul used their differences to the benefit of, you might say, of the gospel. Yeah.
It's interesting in terms of this period of time when the faith in what they call the oral law.
The oral law, okay.
That what governed it, and you see that in the Sermon on the Mount, when Jesus said, for you have heard that it has been said, and that during this period of the period of biblical silence, that their oral traditions began, according to the Pharisees, to take root and take dominance. And there was these oral traditions that you see in place when Christ came.
Okay, so the oral traditions held mostly more by the Sadducees.
The Pharisees.
They were the ones that ran their lives. Yeah, those oral traditions. It's interesting. I read a book. It's another Michener novel. I forget what it was, but it was about a Jewish community in New York. It's a famous book, and I don't remember what it is now. But he actually wrote two or three about that. So back in the late 1800s, early 1900s, things like this is essentially a biography of this young boy that was growing up in the Jewish community and talking about their traditions and the things that they did. Well, he said it back at that time in the Jewish ghetto, and my understanding of the real application of the word ghetto is it's simply a place where a certain group of people live. It doesn't necessarily imply a horrible place. But in this Jewish ghetto, in order to get around the rabbinical admonition of a Sabbath day's journey on the Sabbath, apparently the rabbis back in these oral traditions had said that you can walk a distance that's greater than whatever a Sabbath day's journey is if you do so under cover. In other words, you know, inside a long building or something like that. And apparently, they went through the trouble in this particular area of New York City to actually erect pillars and ceilings to where they could walk to the stores and all sorts of things on the Sabbath day and not violate the rabbinical Sabbath law because they were never out from under a cover. They were always under a roof. Now, I'm not sure that I'd be able to go back in the Old Testament and see that it says that the Sabbath day's journey didn't count if you were under a roof. But the rabbis thought that. One of the other things that the rabbis wrote about was that they were not, of course, permitted to do work on the Sabbath day. And so it was against their law for the tailor to have his needle in his lapel on the Sabbath day because he might be tempted to do work with it. So that's some of the oral traditions. This community in New York City was of the Hasidic community, and so they're the ones that you see. Mostly, you'll see pictures of them at the wall in Jerusalem. They're the ones that wear all the black and they have the tall hats, and then they have the curly hair that comes down the sides, the Hasidim. And they're essentially the equivalent, I would say, today of the Pharisees. And it was an interesting book. I'll have to look up the name of it because it had some very interesting Jewish history in it, contemporary Jewish history. Anyway, when we open the New Testament, we find that the difference between Jerusalem of 450 years ago and now is just night and day. I mean, before it was a poor, city of people that were not observant of God's law at all. And now, 450 years later, we find a city that is prosperous, under Roman, not Persian rule, and people that were extremely careful, it says, to observe every detail of the law. Very much so. Now, the things that we looked at, Nehemiah found them, as we've already discussed, ignoring the Sabbath laws. But Jesus found the Pharisees, they objected when he healed somebody on the Sabbath day. And he had to speak to them about that. So we look in the fifth chapter of John, we see discussion about that. And Jesus had a number of things to say in various instances about people who were upset because he healed somebody on the Sabbath day. I think the interesting thing to note is that What did Jesus do on the Sabbath day? He healed a person. They were more interested in the fact that he had done work on the Sabbath day than in the fact that he had taken a lame man and raised him up, or took a person whose arm was withered and straightened it out so that he could use it. They were apparently not at all, at least as near as I can tell, impressed by the miracles. What they were impressed with was the fact that, as far as they were concerned, he was violating the Sabbath law. But they did say at one time about the apostles, right, that they've done a notable miracle, which we cannot deny. That of course, wasn't on the Sabbath day, but that was after they had admonished these people not to preach and teach in Jesus' name, and they were doing it anyway. So we must ask then, in the 450 years that we're talking about, what brought about these changes? The Bible doesn't tell us what brought about the changes. We have to look at secular world history to find out. All right. So as we do that, we see that the Persian Empire remained in control after the Old Testament closed for about a century. Let me see if I can escape from this without having to redo my entire thingy here. Here, I'll do this. Yeah. I have it open. Let's see what comes up now. Nothing. All right. To have to reset my display setup every time that I launch Excel. I don't understand why. Not Excel, I mean PowerPoint. All right, so if I look at this now, I put together someone, I guess it was Carolyn, or maybe it was Lynn, asked about, well, we ought to have a king's list for the Assyrian, Babylonian, Medo-Persian kings so that we can look at them. And so I went to a website this morning and found this about the list of Assyrian kings from way back to 883 B.C. Interestingly enough, not in Assyria. And then Babylonian kings from 625. I looked first for the list of Babylonian kings and found a list of Babylonian kings back to the year 1996 B.C. So Babylon had been around for a long time. As a matter of fact, it wasn't until way at the end of this list that I found the kings that we were aware or that we were concerned about. So when we look at the Persian Empire remaining in control for about a century, it says, after the Old Testament closes, we realize that Belshazzar, for example, who was co-regent with who? Nabonidus, his dad. His kingdom was taken away by Cyrus the Great. Notice we have an overlap here. So Belshazzar was around from 552 to 542. And Cyrus the Great was already in power in the Persian Empire at 550. So that's, 8 years before this, before his ended right there. And then Cyrus was good for another, 12 years? 12 years after he took over, is that right? So Belshazzar, his reign was until 542, and Cyrus lasted until 530. That's 12 years, right? I think so, yeah. It's tough to do that. But a lot of these people are familiar to us, all right? Cambyses, we know also as who? I think that's the one that's Ahasuerus or Artaxerxes also, one of the Artaxerxes, even though we have Artaxerxes the first here, though this Artaxerxes here might have been the one that we're... You know, this Cambyses, that's the one that they wrote the letters to. That's the Ahasuerus Artaxerxes that they wrote the letters to stop them from doing things. And then this Artaxerxes down here is the one that was during the time of of what's her name? Esther. 478 to 473 is what I have down for Esther. For
Xerxes.
Xerxes, okay, yeah. Yeah, 478 to 473 is what I had as far as just the story of Esther went that we have in the Bible. So Xerxes, and then Artaxerxes, his son, is in there. But these are the people we know about. We know about Darius, and we don't know anything about Bardia, is that what it says, as far as biblically goes. But we see that these people continued down to 330 B.C. until we get down here to Darius III. Well, that's well past the time that the biblical story closed out. The number of kings that we had here, and I forget which one it was that, you know, we don't see anything biblically about when the Persian Empire ended. But we get into their conflicts between the Greeks and the Persians in secular history. That's very interesting. And of course, that's where the movie The 300 came from, with the Spartans holding off one of the Dariuses, I think. And and I've got something I wanna say about this, if I can get my PowerPoint to launch again. And so restart this. So as I say, the Persian Empire remained in control for about a century after the Old Testament closed, and they continued to push their borders outward during this time, and they finally met a foe they couldn't conquer. And who would that have been? The Greeks. Thus the movie. So the Persians had a tough time with the Greeks. They tried to move across into Macedonia and all that sort of stuff, and they were just met by people that just didn't want to give up their lands. And so, of course, the Persian army was kind of stretched by that time. They were well away from home. They were all across. They were all the way away from the across the land of Turkey, as we know it today, a long way from Babylon, because Babylon continued sort of to be the capital city even of the Medo-Persian Empire for a long time. As a matter of fact, that king list that I had, it talks about Cyrus and Darius and things like that still being Babylonian kings, because essentially their main capital was still in the city of Babylon, which was really still an impressive city, very centrally located. Though when we look at the story of Esther, we realize that there was a palace in Shushan, right? Which my secular history guy says was Shushan was used in the summer, because it was up at like 6,000 feet or something, and was a lot better than Babylon, which was apparently very humid and, you know, extremely hot in the summer, as people that are over there now realize. And, you know, troops come back from there, they tell us, they talk about temperatures of 120 degrees. You know, you really can't perceive of that. I mean, it gets to 110 here, and we start to get a little bit warm. So I would think that 120 would be something. So the Persians remained for a while. But Cyrus, who was the first king, he wanted a foothold in Europe. Now, that's interesting. Let me just go ahead and go on to this map here. The thing that we want to understand is that we have been talking about an area that, nominally speaking, we call what? Asia. To put it very, very broadly, we refer to this now as, what do we call that? The churches of Asia Minor, right? So I don't know whether this whole area was referred to as Asia Minor or what, but generally speaking, in geographical terms, this area down here all the way over is called Asia. So we have Western Asia, and, you know, so when we talk about the Middle East, we're talking about the Middle East because it's east of us, and it's sort of in the middle. But it's it's generally referred to as Asia. But this area up here is referred to as what? Europe. And when now we're starting to get up into Europe. We're starting to meet European peoples now. Before, we've been associated with only people who are from our nominally local area. Now we're going to start meeting people that are Europeans, and they are markedly different. A lot of these people from Greece and things like, they came down from up here. They didn't start here and move this way. They came from the European area and moved down. We're looking at different people with different beliefs and different ways of acting and things like that. And so we meet folks that are different than we've met before. I'm going to go back a slide now to, I hope, to where we were. Yeah. So Cyrus, you know, wanted to get a foothold in Europe, specifically, I think, Greece, Macedonia, Achaia, things like that. And then Darius, the third king, he actually attempted the invasion. He took Thrace and Macedon, but the Greeks held out for a lot, and that's where we see some of these historical movies that we've seen around lately. So we realize that Darius wanted to take this area up here of Thrace and Macedonia, and Achaia is what's down here further, though I don't know whether it was named that at that time or not. So they tried to do that, but what they're trying to do is cross over from Asia to Europe. So what city do we have? Can you see it there? It says Byzantium, right? What else do we know what Byzantium is? Istanbul now, and it was Constantinople. And who named it Constantinople? Emperor Constantine of the Roman Empire. Okay? So Byzantium, I guess, was what it was known before it was Constantinople. I guess they can never make up their mind what they want to name their city. So so they try to and so anybody know what this strait is right here called? Between the Black Sea and the Sea of Marmara? It's the what? It's the Bosphorus Strait, okay? And then this area right here, and you know what that is? It's called, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, it's called the Dardanelles Straits, okay? The interesting thing is, and we'll look at this much more closely in a minute here. The interesting thing is that there is a complete break from here to here. The Black Sea flows directly into the Mediterranean Sea, and vice versa. And we'll zoom in on, if we have time, we'll zoom in on this on Google Earth, and I'll show you just how intimidating that particular break in land can be. So the Medo-Persian Empire tried to break into Europe. And then Darius didn't have a whole lot of luck with that, and his son Xerxes tried again. He talks about crossing the Hellespont and marching through Macedonia, and that he defeated the Spartans and occupied the city of Athens. And then I think I have another one. Is it? Oh. All right, yeah. Then the Greeks fled, rallied their forces on the island of Salamis. The tide turned, and Xerxes lost a third of his fleet of ships. There was a very famous story about that, too. I forget whether that was in the 300 or not, but there was one where they talked about that. I think a lot of that had to do actually with weather. And then the Greeks, I think, sort of outflanked them and got rid of the rest of their stuff. Defeated twice more in the same year, Galatia and Samos. But let me go back to something. Because it talks about the fact that we went to the Hellespont, right? And let me find my cursor. All right, I'll reset this again. I'm sure there's some display that I can turn that doesn't keep doing this all the time. But but as we come back, I've got Google Earth already up. So you remember where we are, and we're over here in the western United States, right in there in that little delta right there. And but what we want to realize is that is that the area that we're looking at is the Assyria, Babylonia, Medo-Persian Empire area. And I've left this on so that we can see some of the local countries these days. But this was all the Assyrian, Babylonian area. But here's the Black Sea, and here's where they were trying to get across to go to go over to Greece, really. And if we look at this particular area right here that I mentioned to you as being the Dardanelles, that's what in the past was called Hellespont. And it simply means, I believe it means Lake of Hellas. And Hellas was one of the women that was sought after during the Trojan War, and she was killed as part of the battle. And the city of Troy was located right in this approximate area right here, and the battle for the city of Troy took place on the Asian side, took place over here. And so this area is called the Hellespont, but all this area in here is called now the Dardanelles, and then up here, remember, it's the Bosphorus Strait. The interesting thing to look at in just a couple of minutes that we have is that, let me turn the sidebar off here, and we'll zoom in on this a bit. So we're looking at a satellite view of the Hellespont area. What do you suppose those little things there are, the little white things? Ships. They're not little ships. They're big cargo containers. That is not an insignificant difference, a distance across that water. So it's not like they went out here to Kanakale and just, you know, jumped across to Europe. They built a bridge. One of the most amazing feats that was ever done in ancient history is that Xerxes, one of the Xerxes anyway, built a bridge. Well, they built a bridge across this narrow area. They also built a bridge somewhere else. And after they got it built, a storm came up, destroyed the bridge, and probably a bunch of people to go along with it. And what did Xerxes do? Xerxes not only killed the people that built the bridge, but he required the Hellespont to be punished. And so they had soldiers go in and hit the water with torches and scream against the water. Now, the author here of this secular history book said, though that sounds strange, it was not out of character for Xerxes. I thought, oh, we must know something about Xerxes. not a particularly sane guy. As a matter of fact, I've got a picture, I think, up here on the Dardanelles that shows, is this the one that shows? It doesn't. There was another one that had a picture of them beating the water with their swords and with their torches and things like that. So anyway, he was a strange kind of guy. After a while, though, they decided that, well, what they needed to do was they took a bunch of, looks to us like canoes, but they're really, really big boats, really, really big. They were quite large. And they lined them up in the direction of the current that flowed. Apparently, previously, they weren't that way. They just lined up just bunches of boats right across that strait right there. And then they put cables on them. Of course, they anchored each one of them and all that sort of stuff. They put six big cables across from one side to the other and held them to big old posts on either side with brass rings and just pulled these things tight. And so now they've got the boats secured to these cables that are going across here. And then they put like brush and stuff to start with. And then they put timbers on top of that. They put timbers to begin with underneath the cable. So the timbers were held down by the cables. And then they put brush and stuff underneath that. And then on top of that, they put dirt. So essentially what they've got is a dirt road on a floating bridge going across the Hellespont right here. I had read something somewhere else in a history book that the reason that they put the dirt there is that they could not get the animals to cross the bridge with just the dirt and planks. I mean, yeah, just the brush and the planks. So they needed to put dirt on it in order to get the animals on it. I'm not sure whether this is one of the guys that use elephants or not, but they could not get the animals to go across. And so they finally, I don't know how many elephants they killed first because they wouldn't cross, but, you know. But it was just a huge engineering marvel at that time. And they marched across. Obviously didn't do them any good in the end because they could not take and secure and keep Macedonia and the European places. So if we back off a little bit and look at the Sea of Marmara, I'd never heard that name before, but and we look here and there's Istanbul, we can see that there is a not man-made canal that goes through here, through Istanbul, all the way through the Sea of Marmara, and all the way out through the Hellespont into the Mediterranean Sea. It's amazing. I didn't know that before. This area, of course, this is wider even than that one right there. So if you zoom in on this here on Google Earth, you'll see big old shippies going through there too. So it was not an insignificant thing for them to do. And the only other place, of course, that they had to cross would have been way over here in the mountains of the Uzbekistan and all that sort of stuff, but they weren't interested in that. So, okay. I will be out of town for the next week-ish, and so Chris will have the class next week. And then Mickey will be back next Sunday. Thanks.